Welcome back to the Clear Voice podcast. I hope that you have all had a good week. Starting with questions for Clear Voice, this question is from Lily and she says, I know it's not business orientated perhaps, but I would love to hear about finding and strengthening your voice within your personal relationships, particularly discussing difficult or contentious issues. Lily, this is such a great question and I think it's something that a lot of people struggle with. If it's a stranger who has a view that you don't agree with, then it's a lot easier to either A, have the conversation with them because you're never going to see them again, or B, not have the conversation because, again, you're never going to see them again, so it's fine. And as actually we discussed in the episode later, it might be that you don't want to approach that with them because it's not safe for you to do so. But when it's your family member or a friend or someone, a sibling that you know you're going to see again and you probably love and you have a connection to in spite of their views or them silencing you, then it's a lot more complicated. So, ways to help you. I would start with education and making sure that you know what you want to say in those scenarios. So if there's a conversation that keeps repeating, let's say it's about homophobia, then I would go back to resources around why homophobia is wrong. And that might sound like, well, yeah, obviously we all know why homophobia is wrong, but we don't, because you're having a conversation with someone that doesn't think that it's wrong. So going back to arguments against it and just researching what other people are saying and how other people are fighting it, and then taking your inspiration from there. And then I would conversely try and get your voice heard in other ways and assert yourself in other parts of the relationship or friendship. So maybe it's about what you're going to have for dinner or about where you're going to go, and just speaking up in non-contentious and emotionally driven conversations. And then hopefully you can bring those two together and you can take your research and you can take your newfound assertiveness and put them together in that emotionally driven conversation where they disagree with you, and hopefully you can have a really good conversation. And when you're in that conversation, remember that you're only maybe going to get so far. You win some, you lose some, but as long as you're triggering them to think about their own views, then you're making progress. Another thing that you can look at is changing the way that you communicate and having a more democratic communication process. And that is really led by you, asking them and including them in conversations and trying to reframe that communication that you have. So it's not always two aggressors, it's two people who are equal parties discussing something. So asking them questions and asking them why they think something, and always trying to de-escalate that conversation to keep it in that kind of more dialogue, conversational space. So I hope that this helps. I don't think it's something that's ever solved in a day. And, you know, like anything, finding your voice, changing people's opinions, it just takes time. It takes patience and perseverance. But if you carry on and you do persevere, it all will improve. This week, I spoke to Maddie Gianfrancesco, who is a mental health social worker by day and drag king by night, as Bo Jangles. She's performed at the South Bank Centre, the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, Rich Mix, and has appeared in Italian Vogue and was called a compelling host by The Guardian. We discussed how she found her voice through drag, how comedy can be used as a form of protest or political commentary, and how to speak up in a safe way against racism, homophobia, transphobia, and misogyny, and those kind of situations where it's not safe to speak up at the time of it happening to you. So, let's get into it. Welcome, Maddie. It's so nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And tell me a little bit about who you are and what you do. And for the listeners who already know, you have these two incredibly divergent lives where you use your voice for change in so many different ways.
Yeah, so I'm Maddie, I'm 26, I live in London, and by day I am a mental health social worker, and by night, and also sometimes in the day, depending on when I get booked, I'm a drag king who performs under the name Bo Jangles.
And tell me a little bit more about how Bo Jangles came to exist and what he gets up to.
So Bo came about because I started learning about what drag kings are, because it's really odd to think of the fact that a lot of people don't know what drag kings are. I didn't until, you know, a few years ago. And when I started hearing about Drag Kings, I kind of really knew, like, with a very intense feeling that I really wanted to get involved with that and do that. It came as well, just as I was starting to come out and, like, examine my sexuality and my feelings about my gender, and it really helped work as a tool to, like, navigate that as well. So I did, like, a drag camp, which is...
This sounds amazing. Yeah, I'm so on board
it's
already.
It's so fun. Oh my God. So one night a week for, like, 6 weeks, we met up and we discussed and did, like, improv games and, like, did character work to try and think about, like, because drag is just performing gender. So thinking about how you perform gender and what is gender and all those fun questions.
And is this only kings?
Yeah, well, they kind of had it open, but all of us in the group wanted to be kings. And we're all now in a collective together and we still perform together. It's very sweet. This is like 2 years ago now. And out of that came Beau, and he came from a desire to, I guess, encourage deeper conversations about the ways that Black masculinity is portrayed, because I found that there's these sort of two areas whereby Black masculinity is portrayed as the entertainer or the sort of often like the aggressor, and I wanted to create a character who kind of is an entertainer but also uses that to subvert a lot of the ideas about Black masculinity and also kind of play into them to a level where it's almost ridiculous to sort of hold a mirror up to like our perceptions of that.
Did you know that that's what you were going to do when you went into it?
I had ideas about what I wanted to do with drag, but I didn't really know who I wanted to be as my drag character. And so the workshops really helped me think a lot deeper. And I think I felt like I'd really been struggling and like I was like bottom of the class in drag camp. And then one session, everything just clicked and I really related to him. I think that he represents a part of me which is a lot more, I think, yeah, just cares less about people's opinions and does what he wants to do, and to a level where he's a little bit problematic, but it's also quite empowering to inhabit that space and borrow less problematic elements from him.
Yeah, definitely. And also kind of raise awareness around that problematicness in a way that isn't problematic, if that makes sense, like allow that discourse.
Yeah, exactly. Like, some of the, so I do a bit of stand-up comedy as well as live singing in my drag, and a lot of the comedy is sort of from the perspective of this fuckboy, basically. But because it's coming from someone who isn't a cisgender man, like, the audience feels a lot safer. So the kind of people who normally we'd have a comedian talking about, you know, women in an awful way, and it's like a man who probably goes out and does that awful stuff, when it's not a cis man telling the jokes, like, everyone's kind of in on it, and like it really plays up some of the ridiculousness in masculinity, which is really fun.
It's so much fun. And I think because you were the first drag king that I ever discovered, not that I discovered you, but you know, I like the, in the many drag kings that I've discovered in my life and made famous, you know, but yeah, I saw you on Instagram and I was like, wow. And it was so empowering, I think, as a woman to see another woman inhabiting masculinity in the way that you do, and then also exploring more of the drag king community and seeing how there is such an amazingly diverse range of drag kings out there, and that no one really talks about them, or and they don't get press and they don't get it's baffling to me, because it's amazing, and the drag kings are equally as good, if not better, than some of the drag queens, you know.
I won't tell the drag queens you said that, don't worry.
And it's also because, you know, I feel like drag queens have this massive like history and heritage behind them, and the fact that drag kings are operating on this level without that is incredible.
Well, you know, drag kings have actually been around, some would argue, longer than drag queens.
Tell me more.
Well, I'm so glad you asked. male impersonation was something that the Victorians loved. If you think about Victorian music hall, there's Vesta Tilly and some others that I've forgotten, who were the biggest music hall stars of their day, and they would use dressing up as men often to critique class. Wow. So it'd often be working class women in music hall, and they would sing a song and tell some bawdy jokes. and it was often either in like a uniform, so like as a sailor or a soldier, or to sort of poke a bit of fun at upper class men. And then there was also a massive resurgence in the 90s as well, and then sort of dipped a bit quieter again, and it's sort of really booming at the moment.
Do you think that is?
I don't know, like it feels a bit like the Weimar Republic right now, in the way of which you've got all these amazing artistic, subversive, often queer people creating all of this art amongst a landscape where information is being shared, and therefore, like, you know, revolutionary information is being shared so much quicker than we have before. But at the same time, we're kind of seeing a little bit of a rollback in a lot of our rights. So there's a real necessity for people to use drag in a political way to sort of spread messages about everything that needs to be talked about, and also for people to individually use it to explore aspects of themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so interesting how so often entertainment like music, comedy, rap, drag, all of these things, theatre, are used to make our voices heard about political issues in a way that wouldn't be done if it was just straight political campaigning.
Yeah.
It's like that added entertainment is like the little hook that starts that conversation. And so tell me a little bit about how your relationship has been like with your voice sort of through your life until now.
Well, I was, I guess, in a literal sense, I was classically trained. So I did all the grades. I switched to different, I know a lot of people did the cheeky thing where you switch exam boards when you do graded singing so that you don't have to do the theory test.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like one of those life hacks.
Yeah.
So I sang classically first and foremost, but as I got a bit older, love classical music still, but like really fell in love with like singing jazz music, blues music, all of the good stuff. And I guess sort of speaking voice wise, I would do like public speaking competitions at school, and I won all of
them. I'm not surprised by that at all.
Thank you. But I think that as black women, we have quite interesting relationships with our voice, because we often have to either speak out about a lot of the injustices that we see, sort of when a lot of our colleagues who aren't black are just getting on with their childhoods. And at the same time, oftentimes we have to not speak out because we're worried about being sort of labelled as the, you know, angry, oversensitive black woman, all the fun stereotypes. Yeah, so I guess it's been a complicated relationship, and I think that I've only really found my true voice like quite recently, actually. Definitely after uni, after moving to London, after sort of being around amazing black queer people, and I'm really enjoying the way I'm using my voice at the moment.
And do you feel like being part of a community really helps you in that, and a community that you belong to?
Absolutely. You feel more empowered because there's other people kind of at your back who have been through similar things. And I would also say that you can sort of disseminate information and ideas really quickly. So you just sort of level your knowledge up. And then the next time you have to go toe-to-toe with, you know, one of the racists who's come out of the woodwork, or one of the homophobes or transphobes or whatever, like you've kind of got your, you know, that you've got people behind you, people who know what you're going through, and also people who just share knowledge and resources that you can call on.
It's so interesting, isn't it? I think one of the, when people say, like, I don't know what to say, I don't know how to have these conversations, so often the first port of call should actually be, well, just go back to researching it and finding out what you think. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And like, talking to people and speaking to people within your community who also think the same, and strengthening your opinions, and then taking them, I was talking to Victoria Ball from Wide Mindedness, then taking them to the people who disagree.
Yes.
And then when you can have that disagreement, they'll then stretch your opinions and realise where your weak points in your argument are. So then you go back to your community again and then research. And, you know, it's how... But first of all, you need that community, and you need that research and knowledge. And do you think you know, at school, uni, etc., when you didn't feel you had a voice, that not having community was part of that?
Absolutely, because I think that the voice that I had was the voice I'd chosen to have the easiest ride through life.
Wow, that's really hard.
Yeah. I sort of, there were so many layers that I put on myself of trying to appease everyone and not rock the boat and fit in to, you know, the ideals that I at the time like aspired to. And so I think, yeah, it's only been really recently that I've managed to, yeah, find out like what I've actually got to say and how I want to say it, which has been really freeing.
That's amazing. And I think also it's amazing that you say that, and, you know, you're 26?
Yeah.
26. And I think often, especially with social media, we feel like we should be a fully formed person by this age. I'm 27. And again, I feel very similar to you. I'm like, okay, now that this is me. And maybe in 10 years' time, we'll both be like, that wasn't us. Like, this is us.
Oh, absolutely. So much. Yeah. I think we have to allow ourselves to grow and evolve.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think I feel very similar to you. For university, for me, wasn't actually the place where I found myself. I think there's this pressure put on people that university is a place you're going to make your friends for life and you're going to find yourself. And that was just not it for me. I made a couple of friends for life, but it's not, you know, it wasn't that amazing place for me.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with that.
Yeah, it's interesting. And so tell me a bit about a time where you didn't feel you had a voice.
Well, I've sort of touched on it already. I sort of stole your thunder with my previous answer. But, so I'd say there are often times I feel like I don't have a voice. We kind of have to tactically choose when to deploy our voice. And sometimes that means having to bite our tongues in the face of like awful stuff, like you know, run-of-the-mill stuff. Like, I was racially abused at work by one of my clients like last year. She called me the N-word through a translator. So I got called it twice, once by the client, once by the translator.
Wow.
That was really fun.
Wow.
And I think I would always expect that my response would be to tear it down and be like, that's not acceptable and blah, blah, blah. But at the time, like, this woman was getting more and more angry, and I was just like, I'm just going to remove myself from this situation. I can't argue back. I just have to like get out, basically, which just felt so incredibly frustrating. And it felt like I just let the injustice happen. But I also had to think about my safety, about also because this woman was racist, but also a very vulnerable woman. So there was like a lot of play. And I think oftentimes, like whenever I've had like homophobic stuff thrown at me, anything, like sometimes you do feel really voiceless because you just have to prioritize your safety, which is another reason why being in communities with people who have been through similar things as you is great, because you can talk to each other about the frustrations that you have and you can have a rant to them. And, you know, all those times you had to just keep quiet to be safe, you can just sort of let it all out and breathe and just let it all just come out of you.
That's so difficult. Is there any advice that you would give to someone in a similar position to you of sort of knowing when that time might be to have that self-preservation?
I think, you know, your instincts just fire off. It's like fight or flight. I would say, like, yeah, we all have to just keep ourselves safe. You know, if you feel ready and able to head into the fight, that's up to you. But it's absolutely no shame in just needing to remove yourself from a situation and keep quiet in order to fight another day. And you can use your voice in a different way. So maybe you didn't jeopardize your own well-being or safety in that moment with that person, but there's other ways that you can do wider work that are kind of achieving a similar thing. You know, you can do the anti-racism work amongst people who are maybe more willing to listen, who maybe need a little encouragement, or you can speak out about things in another way, and you can share ideas and knowledge and research with people in your community. Like, there's always other ways to do it.
That's so, I think, also so reassuring. I often feel like when, obviously it's a different situation, but when men catcall me in the street or they come up to me or, you know, touch you in that moment, like, it is that kind of fight or flight. And
yeah,
as you say, it's really, it can be potentially dangerous. And then that whole like, I want to be able to say something, but and it's that injustice. But you're so right. Actually, not beating yourself up for not speaking mm-hmm. out in that moment for yourself, yes. and just connecting it to like, you know, I'm going to speak out, but I'm going to do it in that way that is safe for me and isn't putting me in yes. danger.
Yeah. Exactly. It's why I hate when you hear like, oh, why didn't she just say something at the time if she was so uncomfortable?
Oh God, every time.
We're having a trauma response. Like all of these things being catcalled, it's traumatic.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so flipping it, can you name a time where you really felt like, yes, I have a voice?
Yeah, I think doing drag, trying to use the things I say in drag to, I guess, encourage people to think a little bit about, you know, fun things like patriarchy, fun things like racism, but in like a way where everyone's kind of laughing with you, and then it's like they get the moment of the ha-ha and then kind of moments. They're great. I think recently, weirdly enough, I just sort of started posting a lot on my social media about the BLM movements happening everywhere and trying to, I think because I just didn't really know what to do with my anger, so I just put it all online. And I didn't even realize it, but I got messages from a lot of my black friends and followers, a lot of my non-black friends and followers, just sort of saying that they'd really learned a lot from me. And it felt a bit weird because I didn't feel like that was my intention. But also I was happy that in a way I was kind of using social media to sort of speak to everyone and encourage people to join the fight, go on marches if it was safe for them to do so, to donate to causes like BLM UK if they had the financial resources to do so, to sign petitions, to have difficult conversations with the people in their lives about anti-racism work.
Amazing. And how do you, going back to the drag element of it, how do you craft that message, and how do you strike that balance between ha 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 and ooh?
That's a good question. Sometimes I write out sort of stand-up scripts just in the notes app on my phone, but I'll choose sort of, I'll think of like something that I think is quite funny, and I can like craft something around that, or I can sometimes work backwards from the song. So if there's a song I want to do, like I'll think of the themes and work backwards. Sometimes you get people on side, like you bring them in, like kind of holding like a bit of food for a woodland deer. With sort of lighter touch, kind of funny stuff that everybody can relate to. And then once you've got them, sometimes I just throw in just a statement, just a political statement, not even a joke, just something that's true and unjust. And because I've kind of got people there, they're more perceptive in a way. And sometimes I also use comedy. Like I did a gig recently with a drag queen, quite a famous drag queen who's publicly supported Theresa May.
Wow.
And I was on the lineup with her, and I made a joke that there are upsides to supporting Theresa May. In fact, this queen has got borrowed one of the Immigrants Go Home vans, and that's actually how I'm getting home after the show.
and oh, wow, that's very funny.
Well, thank you.
Oh, darn. No, that is hilarious. And well, then you touch on so much in that one line.
Yeah, it's, I hope so. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, there was some other content in there, but I think you can just use comedy to, because I think a lot of the time, like, we're told when we speak out about things we're being too sensitive, but a language that cis white men speak very well is comedy. In fact, they've dominated the scene. So if you kind of wrap it up in a joke, you've kind of got the buy-in, and they can't accuse you of being too sensitive when you're like almost weaponizing it back at them.
Absolutely. And I think you've also just touched on an amazing template for having awkward conversations, or very carefully having those conversations that you want to have about whatever it is, like racism, misogyny, homophobia, of bringing people in and, you know, being friendly maybe, or creating a good communication, a good dialogue, and then talking to them about the issue, because then you're going to have a much longer dialogue with them, and the percentage of conversation that you have in their mind that is awkward or uncomfortable is a much smaller percentage, but it's still there. That conversation is still there, and they're more receptive to it.
Absolutely. And I'd encourage white allies, straight allies, cis allies, male allies to just sort of employ all of those wonderful strategies when they're out doing the work in the communities, talking to their family about like how everyone can build a better world and all the good stuff.
definitely. And so we, speaking of drag kings, we also have to speak about drag queens. And it's interesting that, you know, with RuPaul's Drag Race, there's such a celebration of the drag queen, and that drag queens have so much airtime, and indeed camp gay men have a lot of airtime, albeit kind of within that box of being funny, because that's how it's acceptable on TV. So yeah, what are your thoughts on that and the kind of visibility around drag kings?
I find it interesting because this is a conversation I'm having a lot in cabaret spaces in London, you know, especially now that we have RuPaul's Drag Race UK. And I think if they wanted to continue it as it is, maybe they should call it RuPaul's Drag Queen Race, because it is not an example of all drag, like not even amongst people who identify as drag queens. It's like quite a narrow view. So either do that or bring in some drag kings, or, you know, they always say, well, if you don't like it, then make your own thing. But that's kind of that weird separate but equal nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. Like women's tennis or women's cricket that no one watches and it isn't on TV. Like,
no, are they going to actually pour that much resources into drag kings? And people are going to say, well, people don't know about drag kings, it's underground. Well, so were drag queens, and RuPaul's Drag Race was a very low budget thing where like Vaseline was like smeared over the camera, and now it's huge. Like, all we need is investment and people who have, you know, big platforms to champion us, because as you said, like, we are pretty great.
You are
I think, love the scene.
Do you think that it comes from the point of view of the patriarchy finding the idea of women performing as men and being realistic men absolutely terrifying? Do you think that's why?
Potentially. And it's also because it is often laughing at masculinity, and for people who claim to be funnier than women, like a lot of men just are a bit sensitive about that area and can't take a joke. And it's also a way where a lot of non-binary people and trans men explore their identities. So it's, drag is a really important tool in that way. Yeah, I think that patriarchy exists even in LGBT spaces. And, we're, you know, we're not exempt from that. And the people who do get the most gigs tend to be cis gay men. And that's probably because they have most of the power in the spaces, and that's probably because of patriarchy, because it's the, you know, we're not immune from it, unfortunately, but I think we're getting more visibility and we're getting more representation, and yeah, now we need sort of to get paid as well as drag queens. That would also be nice.
definitely.
Yeah.
And so how are you using your voice for change now? I feel like we've kind of touched on it, but I'm sure that you've got more.
So I mean, I still find myself posting a lot about BLM related stuff, especially because now I feel like people are kind of exhaling a bit and thinking, okay, we're going back to normal, which is, you know, we can't become complacent. So I'm still posting a lot about that. I'm still doing the odd digital drag show. And then also in my day job, I like to think that I use my voice for good.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about your day job and what you're up to.
Yes, so I am a mental health social worker who works in a community mental health team, which is secondary mental health services. So a little bit more intense, a little bit more support for people who need it. And because I come from a social work background, our values are anti-oppressive practice, empowering the individuals, getting people linked in with their communities. So it means that that's the way I approach working with my clients. So I'm all about trying to help them get the basic welfare rights they need, housing, money, if they want to go back into study or employment or not, because not everyone, there's like a massive stigma about people not being in employment. I often have to use my voice to have difficult conversations even with other professionals in my team or in other teams who have certain ideas about patients and clients, and I kind of feel like I have to fight their corner. Like, I have a client who is a black guy who it's part of his, some other psychiatrist or nurse or someone wrote that it's part of his paranoid presentation that he's scared of police. I raised the issue that, is it paranoid presentation or is it self-preservation?
Yeah.
Which sounds like a really not fun, like, game show game. Section of a game show. Paranoid presentation or self-preservation.
Wow.
Because a lot of mental health difficulties, especially things that are, like, relate on paranoia, they often start out as quite legitimate worries. And then the more stress you have to go through every day, the more it sort of tips and tips into something which is harder to sort of live with. But with this guy, I didn't even think it was that. I think he just avoids police. And it's like, of course he does. Yeah. You know, police aren't always there really to protect black people. So, having to have sort of awkward conversations like that with professionals.
And how do you, because that sounds, I mean, it's amazing that you're there defending people and actually being like, guys, she's being a bit racist here. Basically, right? And the fact that if you didn't speak out about that his whole life, potentially, most definitely his immediate future would be affected and he would be treated in a different way. So, I mean, how do you go about having those conversations? Because this is now, it's kind of a different, it's not just like talking to your racist uncle about why white privilege exists. It's about talking to other professionals who might be senior to you or in a different team. Yeah. How do you go about having those conversations?
It's hard as well because I'm a newly qualified social worker. So sometimes I'm the youngest person, most sort of junior person in a room. But you kind of have to, I guess, think about what you're going to say beforehand. Have your intentions set and kind of speak the language of the person you're trying to appeal to sometimes, or just sort of call on your training. So if I'm talking to psychiatrists, there's sort of certain psychiatrist jargon that you might use and throw in. And also you just have to kind of know your stuff and just back it up with research or whatever. Like if you say, you know, can you explain to me how this is part of this gentleman's paranoid presentation, when actually if we look at the statistics about, you know, police brutality or, for example, stop and searches against black males, it's 10 times, I think stop and searches is 10 times that compared to white men for black men.
And also the intelligence that they stopped and searched people, they actually, I can't remember what I was listening to the other day, they actually compared the intelligence to the people that they stopped and searched, and the intelligence was like black male. That's not intelligence. So, and then they went from the actual descriptions of the people, and they were completely different. It'd be like tall, and they stop a short black man. It's just utterly ridiculous.
Yeah, they have a code IC3, and it means black. And if they just put out on the system IC3 male, we're looking for an IC3 male, then they can just... Anyway. Yeah, if that's probable cause, you know, for them to stop. Because I think they have to... Unless there's like, I want to say Section 60 order, but I could be getting that wrong. Unless there's like a special order in place, they have to justify exactly why they're stopping and searching someone. They can't just do it randomly, in theory.
Mm.
But oftentimes they can just matches the description when the description, like you said, is just black male. That's kind of why it's just really great to think, especially in mental health where black men are way more likely to be detained under the Mental Health Act. So basically taken to mental health hospital against their will, treated against their will.
Wow.
Way, way, way more likely. It's really important to think about how every professional's biases, even black professionals' biases, can negatively impact someone's healthcare, mental healthcare, their life, because mental health services can be incredibly re-traumatizing for people who've already been through a lot of trauma if it's not delivered in a compassionate, anti-oppressive way.
Mm, that's amazing. And when you were saying how you tried to deliver your service, which is inappropriate, could you just repeat it again?
Compassionate, anti-oppressive way?
Yeah.
Anti-oppressive, yeah.
I feel like that's how all medicine and all kind of treatment by any kind of social service, be it police, ambulance, actual social services, occupational health, hospital, that should be how it is administered. But for some reason, the system is so broken that it's not, and that you're doing something different within your service. It's like actually treating people like humans. So it's amazing that there are people like you who are pushing that, pushing that agenda of being human and treating people with respect and compassion. It's amazing.
It's like, it's the social work values that we're trained to uphold, and not everyone does, but and you know it's the same, like, we're not super special, like, there's amazing nurses, and I will say that my team is incredible and they are great. And just today we had our clinical psychologist, who's an incredible Black woman, delivered training to us on racial biases, and like, we all had a conversation about how that can affect how we work with our clients. So I think we are doing the work. I think that a lot of these ingrained ideas are very deep rooted and impossible not to sort of take in a bit because they're systemic. So, you know, the problem is when you're in charge of whether or not someone gets detained in hospital against their will or not, like, then those things can jump out and become really unhelpful. But I think our team is really trying to do the work to make sure that we are as anti-discriminatory and anti-oppressive and compassionate as we can be.
And who are the women that inspire you?
So I would have to say Stormy DeLavery, who is she was a drag king in the 1950s. She was actually in the first racially integrated drag troupe.
Wow.
And she was also
So hang on, just to stop, how, so I didn't even think about this, so were drag troupes segregated?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird to think about it because oftentimes people think about race issues and then like, yeah, sort of LGBT stuff, and like, that's over here and that's over there, but yeah, I think just all drag troupes were like a homogenous colour, and like, for example, a lot of times you couldn't perform at certain venues or, you know, go to certain places if you were Black, or if, for example, you had a Black member of your troupe, then they might not be able to like go to the same dressing room as you. So yeah, but Stormy, so she was biracial Black woman and a butch lesbian, and they would do a thing in the shows where she was this incredibly dapper, tall, bass-voiced, beautiful, well, looked like a man. And all the drag queens would come out and they'd say, guess which of these is the real lady, inverted commas. And then at the end, Stormy would say, ha-ha, it was me all along. But she goes more than that. She is rumoured to have thrown the first punch at the Stonewall Rebellion.
Wow.
Yeah, and she also was a bodyguard in the gay sort of neighborhood of New York until her 80s, and would go around protecting all of her sort of gender non-conforming friends from harassment and harm.
Wow.
Yeah,
she's like a superhero.
She's amazing. She is, I think they called her the gay superhero of New York's village or something.
Wow. So Maddie, where can we find you, and ever importantly, where can we find Bo?
So my Instagram profile is private because I do work in mental health and I don't want all of my clients to see me on messy nights out, especially when I'm talking to them about reducing their alcohol intake, and you know, who am I to talk? So you can try and follow me and I might accept your follow request, everyone. It's at Maddie, M-A-D-I underscore fortune. So yeah, but importantly, Bo, he is at Bojangles Drag, and Bo is spelled B-E-A-U because it's a pun and I'm hilarious.
You are hilarious.
well, yeah, so that's, yeah, follow. And there's like also amazing, incredible drag kings as well that everyone should be following.
So shout out for a few. Yes, go. I talked over you and you're already doing it.
No, of course. Sorry, I'm so keen to like uplift my fellow drag kings. Prince Silver is incredible. Chio is probably the most, like, the top drag king in London, and is just so sick, and is also an amazing like activist, and speaks out a lot about everything important that needs to be talked about, really. Who else? Georgius Michael. I know you're a Georgius
my
Michael
fave.
Fan.
Yeah, second only to Bo, of course.
Oh, thank you. Well, Georgius Michael runs a queer sort of performance magazine called Loosh Magazine. And it's great. I'm not just saying that because I was in it. Dressed up as Stormy DeLovery, who is the iconic woman that I spoke about. Yeah. There is Cyro, is an incredible drag king as well, who talks a lot about black masculinity as well, and talks about like gang inductions and a lot of hard-hitting but really important stuff. Richard Mellon III is a favourite of mine because he has this giant beard and looks like a dishevelled travelling magician from the 1800s.
Wow.
So he's great.
That is the best description I think I've ever heard of anyone. I will put all of those in the show notes for everyone to go and have a look at. Maddie, thank you so much. It has been a complete delight and an education. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Clear Voice podcast. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. Follow us on any social media at Clear Voice Official and email your questions for Clear Voice to hello@clearvoiceofficial.com. And I'll see you next week.